Blog Talk Radio.
This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to the JewelCast. It is 11 o'clock Pacific on February 22nd. Since our last podcast, things have gone well and then very poorly for the Kings, which is why we're going to spend some of our time talking about the Ducks, I guess, because things have gone a little bit better for them. So today, we do have a lot to talk about with regards to the Kings. Jeff Zatkoff is on his way out, but not really. Trade rumors are going on, but not really. And the Kings are playing better, but not really. So we'll talk about all that as we go on. But for now, we're going to go ahead and check in with our good friendly rivals in Anaheim. And we have from the Anaheim Calling blog, our sister SB Nation blog, CJ. And CJ, you are now unmuted. How you doing?
I'm doing really well. How you doing?
Not too bad. Not too bad. I'm almost grateful that the Ducks did manage to close this one out before overtime, because otherwise we'd be broadcasting until about 1 a.m. and nobody wants to listen to that. But Raquel saved us.
Yes, thank you, Raquel. I own his jersey, so I am extra happy tonight.
Oh, it's symbolic. Very good. So, what were your thoughts on the game? Obviously, you're on your way back from the Honda Center. It's a 5-3 win for the Ducks against Boston. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really probably the most entertaining game the Ducks have probably played in at least a month and a half. You know, to be completely honest, the Ducks haven't been playing the most exciting hockey lately. Really, the person who has been keeping the Ducks in it and really been the biggest part of winning these games lately has been John Gibson. I mean, he's been absolutely unreal. He's been, in many measures, statistically the best goaltender in the NHL since the Christmas break. There definitely hasn't been a lot of offense, but they have been squeaking out, you know, some wins. So, it was pretty nice to finally get some good offensive output.
Yeah, and the last two wins for the Ducks before this, one of them, of course, was against the Kings, which we'll get to in a minute. But the last two wins were 1-0 wins, one against Minnesota, who is pretty much the cream of the crop of the West right now, and the other, of course, against the Kings. And from the looks of it, I mean, Bernier had the start today. Gibson is day-to-day, which is another interesting point. But Bernier, I know there was a quote from the post game. I think it was Bieksa basically saying we owed Bernier one because he's had a very up and down season. He's been, for Kings fans reference, somewhere in between Budaj and Zatkoff so far this year. But he may have to step into a larger role. Are you comfortable with Jonathan Bernier playing the next few games?
You know, that's a pretty good question, to be completely honest. I'm nervous, but I believe that he's got something to prove. After getting yanked against Arizona, after, that bad first period against them on Monday, and, you know, the fact that he's been pretty lackluster the last several games, you know, I am kind of nervous, especially after having been spoiled with John Gibson play for, you know, the better part of 2 months or so. That being said, though, Bernier has a good amount of experience in the NHL. You know, as far as backups go, you can do far worse than him. You know, we'll have to see how he plays down the stretch here. So I'm not, I'll say I'm nervous, but I'm not, you know, freaking out about him having to take over for the time being. I have a feeling that with the right motivation, you know, he can, you know, pull some wins out for the Ducks for however long John Gibson is slated to be out, which hopefully is not very long.
Yeah, he's listed as day to day, so you'll probably be okay on that front. And I actually used the exact same words. I was texting my brother earlier today. The exact words were, "You could do worse than Bernier." And
yes,
the Kings, of course, their backup situation didn't go quite as well. They did manage to pull Peter Budaj out of Ontario, and he's been, you know, I've heard a lot the last few days about how he's been incredible and fantastic, and I think that's sort of overplaying it a little bit, but he's done exactly what the Kings needed him to do. Maybe not more, but definitely not less than they needed. But Jeff Zatkoff, that's the story for the Kings today. It was sort of a matter of time, and a lot of us are learning more about the waiver rules because Zatkoff has been waived, but if he clears, apparently the idea is that he's going to stay in Los Angeles at least until Jonathan Quick gets healthy. So he'll be the rare instance of someone who was waived by the team but gets to stay up. So my question to you, CJ, and this is something on the last podcast I asked our own Derek about this. If I'll put you in the coach's seat here. If Jonathan Quick is healthy, let's say the second to last week of the season, and you have Peter Budaj, who's putting up maybe a, you know, a 916 save percentage, so about average, maybe slightly above average. Would you think about throwing Jonathan Quick into the starter's role for the last few games and potentially the playoffs, or do you stick with the guy who's been playing all season?
You know, I really think that is going to depend on the Kings playoff situation. Obviously, the Kings are, you know, on the outside, I think, looking in on the playoffs right now. But you guys are, if you're not, if I remember correct, you're hovering right there. So you guys still have a very good, you know, chance at making a run for the playoffs, whether it's with the wild card or division. So I really think that's going to kind of play into it. And, you know, the Ducks ran into a relatively similar situation at the end of last year when Frederik Andersen went down with a concussion. And he, you know, had been playing phenomenally for us. And he went down with a concussion in a game against Calgary. And John Gibson had to take over the everyday starter role. And he was amazing for the Ducks down the stretch. He was fantastic despite Andersen, you know, being the proven goaltender before. And when Andersen came back, he came back the game before the playoffs. So Andersen played the very last game of the season. And then Gibson got the start against Nashville for the first couple of games in the series because he was the hot hand. He had gotten them to that point. He had, you know, carried the Ducks through some pretty lackluster play. And, you know, it ended up, you know, Gibson being yanked for Andersen once he didn't do too well in the first couple games and they turned it around. But I think that if I'm in Daryl Sutter's seat, I think that Budaj has done a great job. As you said, he's delivered exactly what the Kings had hoped for him to do in the absence of Jonathan Quick. If you would have told me at the beginning of this season that your goalie tandem was going to be Peter Budaj and Zatkoff backing him up, I would have laughed in your face. So the fact that Budaj has been able to do this, you know, as, you know, what many people would consider to be, you know, mostly an AHL goalie, an occasional backup, I think is really speaking a lot to him. And I think that honestly, from a confidence perspective and to make sure that, you know what, we don't rush Quick back from injury. And I know he's been out for a long time, and I know they're, you know, I don't think there really is a big rush to get him back right now, but I think from a confidence standpoint, I would probably stick with Budaj for the time being, but give him a short leash. The second he starts faltering in a critical situation, whether you guys need those last few games to make the playoffs or you do make the playoffs and you're in those critical games, yank him and put Quick in.
Yeah, and I think the Kings are a little bit fortunate on that front. Obviously not fortunate to have lost Quick for so long, but the timetable is starting to look like he will be back in the middle of March, if not slightly before then. And from now until March 14th, they have two sets of back-to-backs, and one of them is on March 13th and 14th. And those are the last two games that Jeff Zatkoff is allowed to stay with the team before the Kings have to send him to Ontario, or they can hold on to him, but they have to waive him again. And by that point, it's starting to look like Quick is going to be back. They're going to be able to ride Quick and Budai through the last 3 weeks of the season. And over that stretch, there are three back-to-backs. So there's going to be ample opportunity for Quick to try and show that he's 100% or close to it. And I, you know, the reasonable approach, I think, would be to stick with Budai, at least, unless he's had a few bad games in the last couple of weeks. If he continues to sort of struggle down the stretch, then it's an easy choice. But if he keeps playing well, I think it would be very reasonable to keep him in the lineup, but Quick's reputation precedes him. And if he is anywhere close to being good, then that last week where it's Edmonton, Calgary, Chicago, and Anaheim in the space of a week, I feel like Quick is going to play probably three of those four games. And hopefully the Kings are at a point where they don't have to rely on Quick for that stretch.
I would definitely agree on that with you.
Yeah. But it's you know, it's an interesting situation because last year, and I had sort of blocked this out, but last year the Kings and the Ducks were 1-2 in the Pacific Division going into the final day, and the Kings blew a 3-goal lead against Winnipeg to essentially hand Anaheim the division. But in this year's run, it's not going to be you know, if the Kings managed to finish second in the Pacific, then everybody would be overjoyed. But we're coming down the stretch now. We have San Jose, who's 5 points out in front, maybe three actually after today's results, and then Anaheim and Edmonton, who both won today. So they are 3 points actually now back of San Jose. And then there is a 10-point gap to Calgary and then L.A. CJ, who do you think is going to win the Pacific? Do you think San Jose holds on?
Yes, I do think San Jose holds on. I believe Anaheim has not been playing, you know, quite frankly, consistent or well enough, while San Jose keeps, you know, playing fundamentally sound hockey. And the Oilers, I would say, probably in a, you know, similar situation to the Ducks. I don't think anybody's going to be able to catch San Jose.
Yeah. So the follow-up question then, that would lock, you know, barring something crazy down the stretch, that would lock Edmonton and Anaheim into the 2 and 3 spots. How do you feel about a potential Ducks Oilers matchup? Do you think it favors Anaheim?
You know what? I do. Just barely, though. The Ducks have played very well against Anaheim, and really, to me, the key in a Ducks Oilers playoff series is going to be checking that top line, that Connor McDavid line. Obviously, he's going to get a lot of chances, and I believe if I'm recalling this correct, that McDavid only has, I think it's 2, maybe 3 points so far in his short career against Anaheim over, you know, 9 or 10 games, something along those lines. So a lot of that's due to the Kessler line really, really keeping it close, really checking him hard and neutralizing him, and they've done a fantastic job so far of that. So the Ducks have been good with that. The problem is, though, is that it's a 7-game series. Will McDavid find that extra gear? Will McDavid and, you know, whoever's playing this up at the top, whether that's Dreisaitl, Maroon, you know, whatever McClellan decides to go with, you know, are they going to be able to wear that line down and get those chances? Because that top line, you know, specifically McDavid, is extremely fast. And the Ducks have shown that they've had issues with fast teams over the years. So I believe that, you know, overall, just, you know, based solely on paper, I think the Ducks have an edge in that series. But the fact that it's seven games and, you know, gives McDavid his first playoff exposure is really going to, you know, cause some interesting problems for Anaheim.
Right. And yeah, and you are correct on the McDavid front. He's got two assists in six career games against the Ducks, no goals. And that transitions into something else I wanted to talk about too. Before I get to the Kings playoff expectations, is Ryan Kessler, because with both the Kings and the Ducks, they've got a defense core that's pretty strong, featuring plenty of young pieces that are starting to make themselves known. But the forward cores are guys who have been there for years and years. And, you know, the Ducks have Rickard Rakell and Jakob Silfverberg and other players who have, you know, are on the younger side, like the Kings have Toffoli and Pearson. And but the guys who are supposed to sort of carry the water are the older players. And we're gonna get to Corey Perry and Andrei Kopitar and guys who haven't met expectations to this point. But the picture I used for the podcast promo today was of Jeff Carter and Ryan Kessler at the All-Star game. And they are both players who their best years were supposed to be behind them. And Jeff Carter has 29 goals and Ryan Kessler, I don't recall exactly where he is in terms of goals and points, but he's one of the, I think he's the second leading scorer on the Ducks. And
no, he's the leading scorer on the Ducks.
Leading scorer. All right. Yeah. I think it's him and Gesslop sort of playing tug of war there. But Kessler,
yeah
he's been scoring goals. He's the defensive work that he's put in, getting nominated for the Selke, I think 5 years after he last won it, was pretty impressive last year, and he's followed it up this year. And I know from a Kings fan perspective, Kessler does, for whatever reason, seem to play really well against LA. Are you surprised to see Kessler at this effectiveness, or did last year sort of preview this kind of season from him?
I'm more surprised, I think, than anything else at his offensive output. His defensive, you know, normal two-way play, completely expected. And he's definitely stepped it up this year. He really has. And so I think that was to be expected. But I did not, and I don't really know of who expected Kessler to come out and, you know, be the team's leading scorer here. You know, that position has usually been reserved for Ryan Getzlaff, for Corey Perry. I think a lot of people, you know, including me, had a feeling that Rakell would be up there in that conversation after his breakout season last season. But the fact that Kessler has been so effective to the point now where many people, including the Ducks beat writers and internally within the organization, they're actually now considering the Kessler, Silfverberg, Cassiano line the top line now, the number one line. And so he's definitely getting older, and, you know, he's had health problems in the past, which, you know, knock on wood, he really hasn't seen in Anaheim, which is fantastic. So I think this is a good place for him. But again, I think a lot of us are very pleasantly surprised with his offensive output, probably the best offensive output, you know, that he's been giving since his 2011, you know, Selke winning season.
Yeah, and I think there are a lot of parallels here with Jeff Carter, and I probably don't need to talk too much about Jeff Carter, assuming that most of the listeners are Kings fans. But Carter had one season that sort of compared to this in Los Angeles, and it was back in 2013, which is the strike season. And I think he was second in the NHL in goals that year, shot the lights out for the better part of 40 games, and then didn't get a chance to see how far it would sustain over the rest of the year. But the one distinction that I'm seeing with between a guy like Kessler and a guy like Carter is that on the Ducks, Kessler is leading the forwards in ice time. He's getting more responsibility than Getzlaff or, for that matter, Corey Perry, who's actually trailing behind a couple other guys as well. Whereas on the Kings, it's still Andrei Kopitar that is the far and away the ice time leader for the Kings. And Carter is second, but he's only, I he's not even playing 18 minutes a game. He's pretty much in line with guys like Toffoli and even Dustin Brown in that respect. So it's what you said about the top line. There have been sort of whisperings about that with LA that, oh, well, if you're putting Jeff Carter and Tanner Pearson out there together, who have 48 goals combined where nobody else has more than 10, then maybe that's your top line. But Daryl Sutter is still not using Jeff Carter like a first-line center. He's giving him, obviously, plenty of power play time, and he's taking advantage of it. And he gets shifts when the Kings are down a goal or when they're in the offensive zone. But it's clear that Sutter still considers Kopitar his workhorse, even if the numbers haven't backed that up this year. But Kessler, I think, plays sort of the Kopitar role for the Ducks. He's the defensive stopper who can also contribute at the other end. The difference is that Kopitar has 6 goals this year and Kessler has 19 or 20, I think.
Yeah, that's a very good comparison. Obviously, you know, Kopitar has been in the, you know, second race for quite a while now, and he's certainly got that reputation. And I know that the Kopitar line tends to, you know, even with the Ducks' success over the Kings the past few years, that Kopitar line has, for the most part, you know, really kind of kept us in check. So we've seen that in a lot of the matchups with the Kings. And that's something, though, that I think that Sutter is really going to have to look at and, you know, potentially make an adjustment on if it continues on this route. I know Kopitar is, you know, has been having a little bit of a down season, you know, on the offensive side there. And obviously we've all heard plenty about, you know, Jeff Carter and what he's been doing there. But, you know, the Kings, I think, are in a pretty similar role to the Ducks right now in that, you know, goals some nights can be hard to come by. And you want, usually, you know, whoever's been your hottest goal scorer, whoever's been your best goal scorer, you want to give them, you know, try and maximize their offensive ice time on that. And so that's what Carlisle has done for this line. You know, Carlisle does get a lot of crap from a lot of people for a lot of things, and sometimes rightfully so, but I do have to give him a lot of credit for recognizing who his best line is out there night in, night out, and giving them the ice time. Kessler has been the ice time leader for the Ducks for forwards if I remember correctly, probably the last, you know, couple months at least or so, maybe more. So that's something that I think that Sutter, you know, may have to take a hard look at, you know, as you guys make a run to the playoffs.
Yeah, and it's an interesting problem to have because this is, you know, I don't think anybody is arguing that Andre Kopitar is going to, you know, score 9 goals a season for the rest of his career. I think, and as much as I hate to draw parallels between Andre Kopitar and Corey Perry, because one of them, his jersey hangs on my wall, and the other one, I don't even want to mention by name, but they both have had seasons where, you know, they've, the last few years, every season they're shooting above 10%. They're getting 20, 30 goals, in Perry's case, even 40 in a couple seasons. And suddenly that, whether it's that shooting luck that has disappeared, or if you want to attribute it to any number of other factors, whether it's nagging injuries or deployment or other guys are picking up the slack, or, you know, his skates aren't sharp enough or whatever, like, whatever reasons you want to chalk them up to, the seasons they've been having just haven't been up to their usual standards. And Kopitar, I think he's getting more attention. Number one, because Perry has found his game to an extent. He's up at, 40 points, I think, whereas Kopitar is still hanging back at 33, something like that. But also because the Ducks are doing well and the Kings are struggling. And now that Andre Kopitar is the captain, the number one thing when I read the Jewels from the Crown mentions or the feed during the games, during the losses, is that Kopitar needs to step things up. And, I don't know if I disagree with Daryl Sutter putting Kopitar out there a lot. Even in the middle of his worst season in, you know, almost a decade, his defensive game is still strong. Players on his lines are still, you know, doing about the same as they usually do. It's just that it hasn't all come together, and Kopitar's shots aren't going in. He's getting robbed or hitting the post on most of his good scoring chances. So I don't think it's a bad idea to keep playing Kopitar a lot, but I do think that there's an argument to give Jeff Carter more ice time, especially when you're saying that he's getting less ice time than, you know, four forwards on the Ducks are right now. Sutter likes to give Drew Doughty a lot more responsibility than his other guys, and he likes to top load his defense. But with the forwards, it's always been a much more even balance behind Kopitar, and, you know, it's worked well enough for a few years now. I don't think it's a bad idea to continue that with Daryl Sutter. But now that
I was just going to say, you know, I think that the other thing you need to realize when it comes to ice time, and why the Ducks have, you know, why these forwards have so much ice time, is keep in mind who our coach is, Randy Carlyle. Randy Carlyle is notorious for severely underutilizing his fourth line. With Boudreau for so many years, Boudreau was, you know, the kind of golden standard of rolling four lines every single night. Now with Carlyle, our fourth line, you know, drops to below 10 minutes a night. You know, a lot of times, especially earlier in the season, when we had, you know, some definite bottom six holes and questions, those guys were getting less than 6 minutes a night on average. And things have picked up a little bit now with Nate Thompson coming back off of long-term injury, Joseph Cremarosa getting called up from San Diego and filling in a pretty effective checking role down on the bottom there. But that is another thing, though, as well, is that, you know, at the expense of this fourth line ice time, you're generally going to see, you know, especially your top two lines logging, you know, crazy minutes for offensive players.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because on the Kings, I'm looking at it right now because I cheat during the podcast. Every Kings forward has at least 10 minutes of ice time per game. There's nobody who has like the Jared Bull role for Anaheim, where they get on the ice for 6 or 7 minutes a night. Sutter's been impressed with players like Andy Andreoff and you know, Jordan Nolan and Kyle Clifford, who have been there for a couple years, and even especially in Andreoff's case, if the goals and the assists and points aren't coming, he just likes the way they play, and he likes that he's able to use them in the offensive zone or the defensive zone. And because of the way the Kings system works, it's usually not going to cost him. And you start to see the issue with that when, you know, you have Jeff Carter not on the ice with 4 minutes left, and instead you see Andreoff and Clifford and Nolan cycling around the boards effectively, but not able to get the scoring chances. So it's a philosophy thing, and Daryl Sutter's been around long enough that I'm inclined to trust his approach, but it also has never paid off to the point in the regular season where they could be in a position like the Ducks are in now. So it's, you know, with Daryl Sutter, you take what you get. And I think given the team that he has and given the lack of top end scoring options, I don't disagree with the style.
Absolutely.
But in terms of Randy Carlyle, are you you're overall fairly pleased with the job he's done, or at least has he exceeded expectations for you?
If you would have asked me this question like a month ago, I probably would have been a little more positive. Lately, yeah, it's been very frustrating. Now, I think that I'm known kind of as, you know, the self-proclaimed resident optimist at Anaheim Calling. You know, I came into the season and there was a lot of doom and gloom. I know from a lot of longtime Ducks fans who were quite frankly not happy with Carlisle getting rehired. But
sure.
I was the person who basically went, look, if he says that he's had time to study the game to change some of his tactics, if, you know, he was brought back, he got the vote of confidence from the very guys who he lost back when he was fired first. Getzlaff voted for this. Perry voted for this. Fowler voted for this. Even Timu weighed in and voted for this. So I was willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I think that he still gets criticized maybe a little too much based on his reputation. Lately, the issues I've been having with him have been mostly related to the players that he's playing. Tonight is a perfect example. The bottom pairing defenseman tonight was Kevin Bieksa and Corbinian Holzer. Brandon Montour, in his few games that he's played with the Ducks so far, has been amazing. He's been incredibly fast. He's generated a lot of shots. He's had some great Corsi numbers last time I looked. And he's just been, you know, fantastic on so many levels. And he was scratched tonight for Corbinian Holzer. And Randy Carlisle, I truly believe this is one of his things that he hasn't really changed yet, is the fact that he likes to play the old school physicality matchup. You know, the Bruins are, you know, one of the bigger teams in the East, and they do play a little more physical than some of the other teams out there. And so, you know, Carlisle wanted to throw a Holzer out there because Holzer tends to play a more physical game, whereas Montour, you know, is obviously more of a finesse speed game. That being
yeah.
said, with how well Montour has been playing, I just, to me, there is no logical reason other than that you should really be scratching him. And not only that, the Kevin Bieksa problem. Kevin Bieksa, and I'm actually in the process of, you know, writing an article on this because I've just about, you know, had enough, and I think a lot of Ducks fans have as well, that Kevin Bieksa continues to get ice time every single night, despite the fact that, quite honestly, most nights he's directly responsible for at least one goal scored against the Ducks. And I really need to dig into his stats a little more because, and I have in the past, and quite frankly, they're ugly. In fact, one time, you know, just for, you know, just to amuse myself, I put BX's advanced stats and Hampus Lindholm advanced stats side by side to one another.
Oh no!
And you know, I think I spent the next 10 minutes straight laughing at how big the gap was. And,
yeah,
and the thing is,
not
like
gonna be
Carlisle. Oh my goodness! And the thing is, Carlisle scratched Sami Vatanen earlier in January for some poor play. Vatanen, you know, has been having some issues this season. He's definitely taken a step back from, you know, a great season that he had last year. And he got scratched because he had a couple, you know, of bad games that he put together, and Carlisle scratched him and sent him a message. And even with Vatanen's struggles, Bieksa has been so much worse night in and night out. And for the life of me, I cannot figure out why he hasn't been scratched even for one game to send a message. He continues to get time in on the ice. Tonight he got power play time. Why is Bieksa getting power play time? I have absolutely no idea. So a lot of it has really been the playing choices, who he's deciding to play. Some of his line combinations lately, especially on the offensive side of things, I've been a fan of. He recently kind of, you know, Carlisle recently blew up the lines a little bit to where our top line is now Kessler, Sulfaberg, Cogliano, which is still intact. That's the only one. But the second line now is considered to be Ryan Getzlaff, Andre Kasha, and Nick Ritchie. And the third line is, with tonight him making his debut, Nick Kerdiles, Ricard Raquel, and Corey Perry. And I really like those lines. And all three of those lines, you know, have shown to be pretty effective. So I do give him credit for that. But, you know, lately, just with some of his choices, specifically on the back end, it's been really frustrating. And it's reminding me and a lot of other Ducks fans about the stubborn Randy Carlyle who wouldn't change.
Yeah, and it's strange because Perry played 14 and a half minutes tonight, which I know Corey Perry has had an off season, but that seems way too low. But the defense, it's a good transition point because all the talk recently, or at least around the league, has been centered around the trade deadline, especially around sort of the top end forwards that are available, whether that's Gabriel Landeskog or Thomas Vanek, Evander Kane, those guys. And every time Landeskog and Matt Duchene get brought up, the idea is that Colorado is not going to accept anybody in return except a like potential top pairing or already top pairing young early 20s defenseman. And the teams that have been popping up in everyone's mind when that said, number one, Carolina, and number two, Anaheim. So do you think there's a chance that Anaheim lands one of those guys? And if so, which defenseman do you think Anaheim is willing to trade away? Uh-oh, CJ, you there? Looks like you got muted. CJ,
I disconnected. I lost reception there for a second. I apologize. So,
No worries.
I'm back here. Thank you. I did hear the question though. I got that. So, I'll speak to who Anaheim would be willing to part with. Obviously the Ducks have, one of the deepest collections of, 25 and under defensemen out there right now. So that's definitely a big asset. We obviously need, a scoring winger. That being said, the most tradable defensemen right now, I would say, are between Sammy Vatanen and Josh Manson. Vatanen would be preferable mostly because of his contract. He's got a, I believe it's a $4.875 million contract cap hit right now. And the Ducks, are kind of in cap hell right now. So, they would love to shed some salary. That obviously also complicates their trade talks with, some of their partners, especially with somebody like, if they were to go make a run after Duchene, who I believe is making like $6 million a year. So, right. Vatanen would be preferable, but Manson is also an option. If you think of who the Ducks would want to protect in the expansion draft, to me, the main people to protect in terms of defensemen, if you take the three defensemen route, is Cam Fowler, who, by the way, played himself out of being traded. Fowler has been probably the Ducks' best defenseman and one of the best players by far overall this season. It's been, I think, a little while since we've seen somebody who's been so heavily involved in trade talk play so well that he's no longer on the block anymore.
Right.
So Fowler for one, Hampus Lindholm, as far as I'm concerned for the Ducks organization, is pretty much the closest thing you can get to untouchable right now. Whenever I hear people bring his name up in trade talks, I kind of chuckle to myself a little bit. Then it would be one of Manson or Vatanen. Manson would probably be the preferred one to hang on to just because he's still so cheap. Vatanen's obviously, making 4 point something million. And the other thing to keep in mind is that we've got, the Ducks have at least two defensemen who play pretty much the exact same game as Sammy Vatanen does waiting in the wings in Shea Theodore and Brandon Montour. And the only reason they haven't stuck up at the NHL level yet is because there's a logjam and there's no room for them. So obviously we've got what it takes to get a scoring winger. The problem is that Bob Murray is, he's affectionately known among some Ducks fans as Bargain Bob. And he's got a reputation to hang on to dear life to his young talent. And that, I think a lot of that is function of the fact that the Ducks historically have been an internal cap team for so long. The Ducks owners, Henry and Susan Samuoli, have always imposed a pretty strict internal cap limit that's rumored to be about, you know, about $5 million underneath the NHL salary cap. Obviously, that's this year, and they gave the blessing to spend at the cap so we could hang on to both Rakell and Lindholm. But again, you know, Bob Murray has shown that he hasn't been willing to pay big for any sort of premium top-end winger. And that's where the frustration lies, I think, is that if anything, the Ducks play over the last month or so, while winning some games, has shown that really, in my opinion, they are one top six goal-scoring winger away from being a serious Stanley Cup playoff threat. And so it really remains to be seen if Bob Murray, given the aging core of Getzlaf, Perry, and Kessler and all of them, is going to be willing to splurge on that. I think if I had to guess, I'd say he's probably more willing this time to do that, especially and to throw in some picks as well. I think that we're going to be seeing a lot more picks being traded at both the expansion draft and at the trade deadline, just because this draft year is considered to be, you know, a little bit of a weaker one as compared to the past couple years that we've had. I would, you know, in terms of Landeskog, I'm a little wary on him, you know, as a Ducks fan. To be completely honest, he probably ended Simone Dupre's career with a headshot. So Ducks fans
forgotten
have some yeah, exactly. A lot of people have it, you know, and so it's something to keep in mind that he's got a bit of a reputation. I would, you know, much prefer Matt Duchene. I would, you know, flip if we were somehow able to land Matt Duchene, but with the price that he is supposedly commanding, I'm not convinced that, you know, Bob Murray would be willing to shell out for that. That being said, there has been a couple names that I think have popped up that I think are interesting for the Ducks, specifically with Tampa Bay and Andre Palat and Nesterov, who I think are some interesting players that very well could fit into the Ducks system and, you know, command a price that Bob Murray might be willing to pay, depending on what Steve Yzerman decides to do close to the deadline. So, you know, there's a lot of variables going there, you know, but I think the main thing just to consider is the salary cap. You know, for the Ducks, the salary has to work, and knowing Bob Murray's reputation.
Yeah, and I think the Ducks' big trade deadline acquisition last year was Jamie McGinn, and I don't even think they gave up a player to get him. So it's sort of the opposite of the Kings' approach the last few years, where the Kings have been willing to give up young talent to try and land a, or at least they've been willing to give up top picks as well in order to try and get themselves over the hump. And the rentals haven't worked as well the last couple of years as they did, you know, 3 years ago and 5 years ago. But the Kings find themselves in a similar situation where there just isn't, well, there might be room for a top end guy like Landeskog, but, the Kings more so than the Ducks just don't have the pieces to do that. They don't have any good defensemen that are younger than Gabriel Landeskog, and they don't have any, older defensemen that can really match, the value of a Matt Duchene. And if they do, then they're, you know, Jake Muzzin and Alec Martinez, who are both pushing 30 at this point, or I think Muzzin might be 27. But you can see where the Avs, if they, you know, given the amount of time that those names have been floating around and that Joe Sakic has made it known those names are on the block, I don't see why he'd settle for anything less than a guy who could anchor a top pair. So it'll be interesting to see if the Ducks are able to make that kind of move, because they're, like you said, their cap situation is kind of ugly, and that's what happens when you have, you know, Kevin Bieksa on a multi-year contract, and you have to pay Perry and Getzlaf upwards of $8 million a piece. It's just the cap math is not fun for anyone right now.
No, and we'll
see what happens once the draft comes.
It's really funny too, because, you know, I think we as Ducks fans have been, you know, pretty lucky over the last few years to have had, you know, very good cap management for the most part. We've been well under the cap. We've had that internal cap. We've had room to make moves if we needed to. Whereas, you know, we heard for years, you know, in an effort to make runs at the Cup, the Kings, you know, really pushing up hard against the cap. Same thing with the Blackhawks. But the problem is that I think a lot of Ducks fans are starting to come around to the fact and seeing that, you know what, that works. You know, pushing up against the cap is a proven strategy now. Both the Kings and the Blackhawks have proved that. And so I think that's where some people may be starting to get a little bit frustrated there. You know, that, you know, Bob isn't willing to make these big moves and really, you know, kind of screw ourselves over cap wise in order to make a run. Because, and to be completely honest, I would have your guys' cap troubles in an instant if it meant two cups in 3 years. I would take that in a heartbeat. And so I think that's something that Ducks fans are starting to come to the realization to. And so there's been a little bit of restlessness within the fan base because of that.
Yeah, and the Kings fans, don't worry about us. We're already on the far end of that honeymoon after a year without the playoffs and then a loss to the Sharks. But it's a valid point, and I think the Kings are both a cautionary tale and a success story because they managed to get Jeff Carter and Marian Gaborik for reasonable prices. They waited until the deadline, but I think both of those trades were actually a few days before. I know Carter was a few days before the deadline. I think Gaborik, that domino dropped before a few of the other guys. And those worked out beautifully. But then you have Andre Sequeira for a first-round pick, and Sequeira leaves after, I think, 16 games with the Kings and no playoffs. Mm-hmm. And then the Kings, you know, mortgage the future and let Martin Jones go to San Jose eventually for Milan Lucic, who played 1 year. So it's, you know, I don't think anybody would trade the last 5 years of the Kings for anything, but it is interesting now to see for the first time in quite some time the questions of whether the Kings should, you know, cut ties with Dean Lombardi or with Daryl Sutter. And I think from my perspective, the answer to both questions is no, but there are, you know, the arguments for that that are starting to come about, and it's a little bit like when you watch international soccer and you see, you know, the manager of Barcelona winning every trophy imaginable, and then this year he's only second in the league, and everybody wants him fired. It's a fickle business. For the Kings, at least, I think if heaven forbid they do miss the playoffs, I don't think that's the end for Sutter and Lombardi, but I do think that is the, okay, you have one season left. And, you know, at that point, I think Lombardi goes even more all in, and I don't want to think about the consequences of that. So I'm just going to go ahead and go forward and say that the Kings, let's just see them make the playoffs instead.
Yeah, there's a lot of hockey left. I just checked the standings. I think you guys are only 2 points out of Calgary in the wild card spot there. So, you know, a lot can change over the next, month and a half or so. So it remains to be seen. But, you know, if there's one thing that I learned specifically in the 2012 playoffs, then never count out the Kings.
And I am happy to toe that party line as well. But for the Kings, it's one interesting sort of twist now to end the sort of playoff talk before I start assuming the Kings are going to make the playoffs is they're now getting into a spot where they're almost as likely to play the Minnesota Wild as they are to take on San Jose in. The Kings crossing over divisions would be interesting. And I know Anaheim sort of had the reverse of that last year, where they played Nashville in the first round, and Nashville was the central wildcard team that crossed over into the Pacific Division bracket. And if the Kings play the Wild, they get to play Bruce Boudreau, but they also get to take on the top team in the West, and that would set up a potential showdown with Chicago in the second round, which would be really, really interesting to me. But because I want to keep it somewhat focused on the Ducks, when the Ducks played Nashville last year, do you think that having to travel hurt the Ducks and then in later rounds the Predators? Or do you think that getting a chance to go outside the division might have offered some positives there for Nashville?
I think that, you know, really to me, it may have had an effect. I think if you ask every single player in the locker room, they will vehemently deny that the travel affected them at all. But sure. I think it's something that you can't ignore. That long distance of travel, you know, does take a little bit of a toll on your body, especially in a 7-game series. And to me, this was more of a situation of the Ducks playing Nashville and really kind of, to be quite honest, Bruce Boudreau's playoff record. You know, the whole reason the Bruce Boudreau, Randy Carlyle, situation happened, and why more specifically Bruce Boudreau was let go, was obviously not because of his, you know, regular season, 4 straight Pacific divisions. That's not, you know, that's nothing to get fired over. It was the consistent 7, game 7 at home losses. The thing is that Boudreau has repeatedly showed that he can get outcoached in the playoffs. It happened against the Kings in their playoff series that went to 7 games. You know, Daryl Sutter just flat out outcoached Boudreau. Joel Quenneville did that to him the next year. And there's also been a lot of kind of rumors flying around, specifically coming from Timu Solani and his book. Timu Solani was not at all a fan of Boudreau. At one point, even saying he would have preferred to play for the Kings. I almost vomit at the thought of that. But, you know, those are some strong words. And a lot of the criticism was that Boudreau does not know how to motivate his players in tough situations to get over the final hump. And I think that, you know, coming up against Nashville, against a team with a stacked blue line, with some great scoring talent up front, the travel may have had a little bit to do with it. But, you know, when the Ducks went down, you know, pretty early, you know, 2-0, yeah, they did do a good job rallying back. And game 7, the Ducks, I was at game 7. The Ducks actually played pretty well on that game. It's just Pekarinen, you know, decided he wanted to Hulk out and just stomp on the Ducks' hearts there. But to me, it was that game 6 that just they couldn't do anything. There seemed to be a lack of energy. And to me, that really went all back to the coach. So, you know, when people criticize Randy Carlyle, when they really miss Bruce Boudreau, you know, I really feel like, look, this whole move was made specifically because of the playoffs. Let's wait until the playoffs to see what happens. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm really interested in seeing Minnesota in the playoffs this year. They're dominating in the regular season. They're playing a fantastic game. Boudreau is coaching a great game right now with Minnesota. But when crunch time comes around and when that playoff time comes around and if the Kings do face him, you know, really to me, that's when, you know, the spotlight really gets put on the coaches and really where it's going to be interesting to see what Boudreau does in Minnesota, especially against, you know, if they do face the Kings, especially against a Kings team that has historically had a lot of success against Boudreau coach teams in the playoffs.
Yeah. And I remember Boudreau being a topic of conversation at our SB Nation All-Star Weekend Summit when You came up from OC, and we had Jake from Fear the Finn. We had Robin and Sarah and myself from Jules. And, of course, head honcho Travis came in from Washington, D.C. I remember most of that night, but I do remember a lot of talk about Boudreaux and about the Pacific outlook. And before we go, one other thing on that front was there was a lot of talk about hockey in Southern California and to an extent San Jose as well, how it's sort of spread. And you mentioned Nick Curdiles or Curdiles. I don't know what the right pronunciation is, but
I think it's Curdiles, like crocodile.
Yeah. So there you go. So Curdiles, the first player born or raised in Orange County to play for the Ducks. So we've got about 4 minutes left, but we'll squeeze that in. Mm-hmm. So the Kings have had a couple players who have had LA experience. I know there was a guy named Noah Clark who played about a decade ago for the Kings that was from LA. But for the Ducks to have a guy from OC is pretty interesting. And what was the response at Honda Center today? Was there sort of an awareness that this was something special?
Yeah, there definitely was, especially among the social media savvy fans. The Ducks made a pretty big deal about it in a lot of their pregame activities leading up and at the game. I was at the game tonight, and they did put up on the scoreboard that stat that, Curdiles is the first Orange County, born or raised player to play for the Ducks, and that got a nice ovation from the fans. And I think that he was actually born in Texas and moved to Irvine when he was 6 years old. A high school that was actually a rival high school of mine, Beckman High School in Irvine. It's pretty cool to have that local hometown pride. And not only that, somebody who, he's had some issues with concussions lately, so he's been unlucky, but when he has hit the ice, he's looked really good. I was very excited, and a lot of other people were, for him to get called up and get a shot with the big boys tonight. So I think that's really just a great testament to Orange County grassroots hockey. The Ducks have one of the best grassroots programs in the nation right now. They just broke ground on a massive 4 ice sheet practice complex that's going to be one of the largest in the nation at the Great Park in Irvine.
Wow.
Scheduled to open in a couple of years. If you get a chance, there's an OC Register article on it, and there's some great rendering photos of it. Check it out if you get the chance. But, having him up there and having that awareness of that Orange County hockey player really, I think, is going to be good for the Ducks and Orange County hockey in general.
Yeah, that's great. And the Kings have their high school hockey league that was founded last year that has been sort of achieving a higher level of recognition in LA with Jim Fox taking on a huge role there. And with Vegas coming in, with Arizona born Austin Matthews coming into the league too. And it's kind of fun to see that we've, especially with All-Star Weekend and the 100th anniversary of a big celebration in the southwestern United States, it's cool to see that it's caught on. And now with the Kings and the Sharks and the Ducks, again, potentially all making the playoffs. I say potentially because please let it happen. It's good that we're getting to see sort of a, maybe call it a golden era. But at this point, with what you said about the grassroots programs being founded and now players starting to make their impact, I don't think we've even gotten to sort of the golden age of California hockey yet. So it should be fun to watch. But on that note, we are going to go ahead and end it because the podcast manager is yelling at me that we have less than a minute left. So CJ, thanks for joining. We'll be revisiting this, I'm sure, especially with the Kings and the Ducks facing each other at 1 p.m. Pacific this Saturday. And hopefully the result goes the other direction this time. But CJ, thanks
we'll see.
A lot
I'll actually
for coming
be,
on.
Thank you so much. I'll actually be at that game at Staples Center, so looking forward to it. Should be a good matchup, but thank you so much again for having me on.
You got it. Maybe I'll see you there. And for the rest of you, Perfect. Hope you enjoyed. Good night.